Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. A quick reminder, you can subscribe to us on Google Play, on iTunes, on Stitcher, any place that offers a podcast. And if you like what you hear and you leave a positive mention, apparently that does help us. We really appreciate we've been growing the audience, and we are very, very grateful. And we have two guests today. We have Jim Swift, who's a senior editor at the Bulwark, and Christian Vanderbrook, who is one of our contributors and actually came out recently because you actually were known as Brant on Twitter. That was kind of a big deal when you sort of revealed yourself, Christian, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was certainly a big deal for me. I had been anonymous as Brant for about 6 or 7 years on Twitter, and this went all the way back to a previous job that I had at the New York Stock Exchange, and it would have created probably some issues if I were out tweeting my frank thoughts about what's happening in politics and the world. So started off as anonymous, and then some lovely people, some names that we might know, put out a bounty on me for someone to discover my real name and post that. So I decided, you know, I might as well just come out on my own and do it on my own terms. And it's been a great decision so far.
Okay, why don't I talk about your most recent pieces? Before we do this, though, guys, as you know, we are somewhat Wisconsin-centric on this podcast because I actually live in Wisconsin, and there was an amazing election last night in Wisconsin. Maybe this is a little bit inside baseball, but here's a warning shot for Democrats of the price of overreach, because the liberal candidate for Wisconsin State Supreme Court was overwhelmingly favored to win last night, and would have positioned liberals to take control of the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 2020. And instead, in a rather remarkable upset, the conservative candidate, Brian Hagedorn, who was written off by much of the Republican establishment, actually pulled off an upset. And there's a couple of things here. I just got a text from a Wisconsin Republican politician who said, you know, the base here is really woken up. They're woken up because of perceived Democratic overreach. And there's a couple of things that I just, you know, want to lay out. One of the big issues in this race was the attack on Brian Hagedorn for his involvement in a Christian school, which was described as being anti-gay. In fact, he actually lost support from major business groups because he, you know, had been involved in the school that can ban teachers or students who are in gay relationships. And he'd given some speeches to conservative social groups. So this became, the left decided to make this all about religious bigotry. But this created a huge backlash among people who thought this was an attack on his Christian faith and this was an attack on religious freedom. And the Christian conservatives mobilized in a huge way. At the same time, you had national liberal groups filing this sweeping lawsuit against Scott Walker's final lame duck legislative session. Now, you might remember, I actually thought that was kind of a dumb thing to do. I thought it was petty. I thought it was unnecessary and spent too much political capital. But what happened was they got a very liberal Dane County judge to throw out everything the legislature did in this special session, including all of the appointments, things that were not controversial. And it reminded people in Wisconsin how sweeping and aggressive liberal judges can be. And it was very interesting because a few weeks ago, I was at an event and I was predicting that I thought the liberal candidate was going to win for Supreme Court with 56% of the vote. But I remember saying, with one possible exception, that this Dane County, this is Madison, Wisconsin, liberal judge issuing this sweeping order might wake the base up. And they did. The third thing is that the Democratic governor in Wisconsin, Tony Evers, the guy that beat Scott Walker narrowly, turns out to have almost no political skills whatsoever. He said he wasn't going to raise taxes right before the election, comes up with a budget that has no chance of being passed, that proposes $1 billion in tax increases right out of the box in front of a Republican legislature. So it was no chance of winning. And this is the interesting thing. The liberal groups have no chance of winning this litigation, and yet they've spent, you know, a huge amount of political capital that will have tremendous political consequences. You have the governor proposing $1 billion in tax increases that he had no chance of ever getting enacted, but he's given the Republicans a talking point And now basically liberal chances to win the Wisconsin Supreme Court are gone for years. And Eric Holder, national candidates, came in and made this a big referendum. You had many of the Democratic candidates who decided to intervene. So it's kind of a big deal and maybe a little bit of a warning of what happens if Democrats overreach. And Wisconsin, which and I think, you know, the Republicans had been somewhat back on their heels after what happened in the midterm elections. But they got the band back together again. And Wisconsin's very, very much now a purple state. OK, so, gentlemen, I know that it feels like piling on and it's not necessary for me to do this. And it's kind of a cheap shot. But what the hell? What the hell was going on with Donald Trump yesterday? Jim Swift, do we have some of the audio of the president talking about the oranges of the Mueller investigation?
We do. Let's roll that.
I have to listen to it.
Okay, here we go.
I hope they now go and take a look at the oranges of the investigation, the beginnings of that investigation.
Okay, so my favorite part of this is the White House actually put out an official transcript in which they made up the word oranges, O-O-R-I-N-G-E-S, because clearly he's trying to say origins, and he says oranges not just once. I lost track of all the times he said oranges, so, I mean, that was bizarre. Okay, so we all have our, you know, kind of like, I don't know, just bizarre moments where you forget basic words like origin. And then you had the president make this comment about his father. And again, I understand this is not the most important thing in the world, but here's the president of the United States who just had a very strange day yesterday. And talking about where his father was born, we have that sound bite too, right?
Yep, here we go.
I mean, Germany, honestly, is not paying their fair share. I have great respect for Angela, and I have great respect for the country. My father is German, right? Was German. And born in a very wonderful place in Germany, and so I have a great feeling for Germany.
The only problem, of course, is that Fred Trump was born in New York. Now, I don't know what percentage of people who don't know which country their father was born in. Okay, Jim Swift, what the hell?
Okay, so I'm getting dragged on Twitter, and it's a day ending in Y, so I'm used to it, but if you went to your parents and you talked to your parents and you said, you know, where was Gam Gam or Grandpa born? It'd be one thing to, like, get the town wrong, right? You know, not everyone knows, you know, not everyone's family is so close where you just know exactly where it was. But in the case of Donald Trump, where he's from New York, his dad's from New York, I mean, it's pretty apparent. But if you're off by a factor of 1,000 miles, and then you say, you know, Dad, you know, Grandma and Grandpa were not born in San Francisco. They were actually born in, Chicago. You'd be like, wait, how would you get that so wrong? And it'd be one thing. It'd be like one time, oh, yeah, no. I meant my great-grandpa. You know, Grandpa's, you know, Grandpa Trump's, you know, parents were from Germany. Yeah, that's why I got confused. But a second time is kind of weird.
This is a sign of your naivete, Jim, because truth is what the president says it is.
Right? Well, what I loved about yesterday was continuing the fruit theme. So a couple of weeks ago we had Tim Apple, and now we're talking about the oranges of an investigation. So it's kind of a funky insight into how his brain is working right now.
Orange, you glad Trump is president? Sorry.
I know. I mean, every comedian beat this thing absolutely to death. Okay, I'm not going to draw, you know, too many large conclusions, but it was just a bizarre moment for
the president. Well, no, can I jump in here for a second, Charlie? Because last night he was giving a speech to the NRCC, the National Republican Congressional Committee, which is the election arm of the Republican Party that seeks to elect members of the House of Representatives. And at one point, Trump goes, someone's going to leak this speech to the press. It was being broadcast live on C-SPAN.
No shit.
Live on C-SPAN. Now, I realize no one watches C-SPAN, and C-SPAN, they've got good humor over there. They joke about this. But at one point also, he suggested that wind farms cause cancer.
Yeah, the noise of wind farms cause cancer. This is a well known. This is a well known scientific fact.
It's killing all the gay frogs.
Yeah. I have done my research on the internet, and I basically, you can Google that, and something will come up.
I'm sorry. You don't need to have a degree in psychology to say you can point at all of these things within, you know, the past day or so and be like, this guy's not right. Lots of people were willing to do it with DC McAllister when she had her breakdown. If your parents are in this position, you're not going to be like, well, you know, I don't have a degree in psychology, so, you know.
Oh, and the way that the pro-Trump people were diagnosing Hillary Clinton as having a brain injury or unable to walk during the campaign, now they have the vapors about someone saying the president said something that's clearly nuts, and we should be able to say what we're all seeing.
Yeah, no, I remember that. That was all of the speculation about the neurological disorder that we were just going to find out about Hillary Clinton. My favorite response, I didn't do a huge amount of research on this because I don't take it that seriously. But I noticed that Matt Schlapp, of course, feeling the need to come up and punch his sycophancy ticket today, tweets out something like, "Well, are you saying that Fred Trump did not speak German?" Okay, which is like not the point. It's like the Trump world has gotten so used to defending Trump that they'll even defend him against things that have nothing to do with what's actually happening. So Christian, you have a couple of stories that you've written for The Bulwark that I have to admit are absolutely haunting. Let's start with the most recent because it seems relevant. And you're pointing out that, you know, and maybe this is where this moment does become relevant. The president has been increasingly undisciplined and increasingly willing to ignore the advice of his closest advisors, whether it's talking about going after Obamacare, shutting it down completely, everybody in the room saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, with apparently the exception of Mick Mulvaney. The president talking about shutting down the southern border, an idea that I think I described technically as batshit crazy yesterday, although I see that Molly Hemingway is defending it now on Fox News. But the president is increasingly sort of, you know, unbound. And you wrote a piece yesterday in The Bulwark that said, if he's like this now, can you imagine what a second term Trump presidency would be? So talk to me about that a little bit, because I think there might be the inclination of saying, okay, we've had 3 years of Donald Trump, so at least we know what Trump is about. We know the range of Trump behaviors. But what you're suggesting, and I think you're absolutely right about this, is that we haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah, we have glimpses of it. When we see him at a rally or we see him at the NRCC dinner, we see kind of this unfiltered id of what maybe this ideal Trump might be. And then if we go all the way back to the 2016 primaries or even before with the rise of Donald Trump, it's always been this abdication of responsibility. He's going after our enemies. He's going after Barack Obama. Somebody else is going to take care of him. And then when he's running in the primaries, we would see candidates pull their punches against Trump because he was clearing the field. So Ted Cruz says, the media wants me in a ring with Donald Trump, but I'm not getting in there. Jeb Bush is ignoring him and just running ads against his competitors. And only after a candidate would get out of the race would they say, oh, this Donald Trump guy is a real problem. You know, we would see Jindal in his concession speech made it all about Trump. So, and then even during the campaign itself, Never Trumpers, they all thought Hillary was going to win. So it was safe to be Never Trump right up until Election Day. You know, I'll always remember Ari Fleischer, who is now one of the president's most reliable defenders. He wrote an op-ed a couple of days before the election saying he would vote for Republicans up and down the ticket, but he was going to leave his vote for the presidency blank. And now today we've seen the Never Trumpers go completely the other way around, saying, well, we support this guy because he's appointing the judges from the Federalist Society's list. And he's got people around him like Jim Mattis, who's going to keep the international system together and keep us at peace. Gary Cohn's going to keep the financial system together and keep us out of a trade war, and maybe occasionally steal a paper off of the president's desk that he probably shouldn't be signing. We had Rex Tillerson and H.R. McMaster as part of this, you know, trying to keep the world order together. And now today, as we look at it, how is that all working out? Most of those people are gone from the White House. And who has come in? We've gotten more of the yes men. And I talked about in my piece how we started off with, you know, a typical administration would start with an A team that's gradually replaced by a B team of very capable deputies. Well, with the way that the 2016 campaign went and with the type of candidate Donald Trump is, a lot of that A and B team sat it out. So we started off with a C team. And then that C team is now being quickly replaced by a D team. And so you have to ask yourself, what's going to happen in years 7 and 8 of a hypothetical Trump presidency when he has someone who might have been a very junior aide in a typical Republican administration? All of a sudden, they are assistant to the president and they might have a security detail and an office in the West Wing. And it's really terrifying when you think about what is going to happen. We've all
let's go through some of that, because, you know, as you point out, we're already starting to see his willingness to, you know, to take some rather, you know, extreme steps. So in a second term, he will feel absolutely emboldened. He will never have to face the electorate again. He will feel vindicated on every possible level. So give me some sense of you know, and you go through all of this. I mean, you know, I mean, so far, as you point out, he's been blocked on so many things. He's been blocked, you know, U.S. withdrawal from NATO, removing troops from the Korean Peninsula, you know, and ending the Korean Free Trade Agreement, printing money to lower the national debt, you know, fulfilling the, you know, the promise to ban all Muslims. I mean, basically, those things have all been blocked. But an unbound Trump in a second term, what might he do?
Well, I think you can look at his tweets and you can see what are these things that he wants to do so badly that he feels like he wants as a legacy item. So you could see him, you know, he's always complaining about the FCC. You could see him make a move against broadcast licenses. He's pulled media credentials from Jim Acosta. He could pull them from an entire media organization if he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed. I can imagine him calling on a toady loyal attorney general to go after Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Adam Schiff. I could see him calling on the Federal Reserve to cut rates, even if that means replacing the head of the Federal Reserve. He called out Bikers for Trump the other day as a potential loyal gang who might visit Payne on the angry left. So I it doesn't take a lot of imagination to think about what nightmare scenarios a second Trump term could present, not only for the country, but I think if we conservatives and Republicans are thinking selfishly, what does that do to us? Because there have been all of these deus ex machina moments that we've been waiting for, whether it's, you know, Hillary Clinton winning in 2016 or Robert Mueller. So, or maybe, you know, Trump will lose in 2020. So there's always this kind of unspoken thought that, well, someone else is going to take care of him. And I think that it's time for us in the Republican Party and those who have accommodated themselves to really step up and say, well, maybe if I don't do something, I'm going to be the one that they come after next.
Yeah, well, I feel like we've had this conversation over the last several years, right? I mean, this is it's like, hello, we've had plenty of chances to do this, and the Republican Party hasn't done it. And, you know, quite frankly, we had David Beiler on from The Washington Post, our former colleague from The Weekly Standard, who thinks that Donald Trump has about a 50-50 chance of being reelected. And I think he's right about that.
Do you guys remember? I mean, this was not even 10 years ago. This was back when you had your show, Charlie, and I mean, Christian, you know, and might have been at the end of the Bush administration, when Republicans going into the 2008 elections were so obsessed about the Fairness Doctrine. You know, God forbid, you know, gosh, the liberals are going to use the cudgel of government to restrict our speech and punish people for having bad opinions. And now that's awesome. It's so weird.
No, that's a very good point, because I remember being very highly motivated, and we really did think that this would be something that the left might do. And of course they might. I mean, What is interesting is watching how, you know, the left keeps going, you know, talking about all the norms that Donald Trump has violated. And then they say, and by the way, we would like to, you know, completely reapportion the U.S. Senate, abolish the Electoral College and pack the Supreme Court. So, hey, you guys step up here. The other piece, by the way, Christian, that I wanted to talk to you about, and I mentioned I used the word haunted because I think about this story all the time. I was in a discussion yesterday about the prospect of political violence in America. And somebody made the point I thought was pretty good that we have been really lucky in this country so far, in part because of the incompetence of the bad actors. You know, you think about the shooting of the Republican congressman at that baseball diamond, you know, mm-hmm. how much worse that could have been had the shooter been somewhat more competent. You know, what would have happened had the bomber, the pipe bomber, if he had not been so incompetent, you know, the number of people that might have been killed. And you wrote a piece for us a couple of weeks ago that got a lot of attention, and I think still deserves more attention, about this weird genre of, you correct me if you think I'm mischaracterizing this, violence pornography, sort of a mixture of white nationalism, you know, concern about white genocide, and this fantasy of killing liberals, that is written by an author named Kurt Schlichter, who is familiar to some folks. That I won't say this is mainstream, but it's close enough to being mainstream to be disturbing. I think some people know what the Turner Diaries are, the sort of neo-Nazi mm-hmm. Fantasy that motivated Timothy McVeigh. I mean, ideas do have consequences. And your point was that Schlichter's books are basically kind of close to being a ripoff, if not an homage to the Turner Diaries. The General Turnbull is his hero. And they are graphic depictions of evil leftists who are murdered and killed and blown up in the most graphic possible ways. And you wonder how long the right is going to be able to marinate in this sort of, you know, violent pornography without it having some sort of a consequence. And I was hoping that there would have been more of a stigma, there would have been more of a blowback, that you have people like Hugh Hewitt have actually blurbed these books. And Kurt Schlichter sits in for Hugh Hewitt on his radio show. I would think that if there's one thing that ought to have been a consensus for conservatives, it would be this kind of bizarre, sick stuff is no place in the conservative movement. Murdering the libs to own the libs is going too far. And yet I don't sense that that's happened even after you documented this stuff that's out there.
Yeah, Charlie, I would agree with your characterization. And I think that, you know, the most surprising thing for me after I wrote the piece was I expected certain people to be angry and I expected certain people to be silent, but I did expect people to try and mount some kind of defense. And the surprising thing to me was there really was no coherent defense because so much of this is just so indefensible. So it has been a little bit disappointing to see people just move on. And what I tried to do in the piece was just really raise some awareness about, as you said, what's going on just beneath this mainstream veneer of conservatism. And one of the things I noticed is that over the last year or so, there has been this kind of state of emergency leading to insurrection and civil war. There's been this strain of thought on the right. And I noticed that one of the things that would often trigger it would be a sense that the social justice left was going too far. Whether it's these multi-gender bathrooms or Black Lives Matter or reparations, there was always this warning, well, if you do this, then we are going to have a civil war in this country. And that got me thinking, well, when you talk about civil war in that context, what that really comes down to is a race war. So I said, let me go back and read kind of this influential document about a race war, which was, as you said, the Turner Diaries, which is a horribly racist and anti-Semitic screed that was found with Timothy McVeigh after he had blown up that building in Oklahoma City. So I spent about a weekend reading this, feeling kind of like a psychopath with it on my Kindle on the subway in New York, hoping no one's reading it over my shoulder. but I wanted to get a sense of what that was like. And then I went to read a couple of Kurt Schlichter books, and it just made my blood run cold when I would see some of the parallels there, not just with the white genocide conspiracy theory, but with some of the specific scenes giving black people badges and guns to go and take to seize guns from ordinary white people. That was a specific scene in the Turner Diaries, and it is a specific scene in one of Kurt Schlichter's books. And I don't know if it was something that was intentional or if it was unconscious or if this is just one of these ideas that just exists in the ether and it just comes in through osmosis. But we ought to be able to acknowledge what is a really dangerous strain of thought, and we need to get it as far away from us as possible, I would argue, not just for moral reasons, but because I think it's scaring a lot of people away from the party.
Okay.
The longer we marinate in this.
Okay. What about the people who say, look, it's just fiction. It's just a novel. I mean, lighten up. It is just a fiction. No worse than any other spy thriller fiction that a lot of, you know, that people read on the beach or read on airplanes. So, you know, how do you separate out just sort of fiction fantasy from something that's actually real? And why do you think this is real when they're just novels?
Well, I think you can just look at his own words in the foreword to these books where he says that, you know, this is a possible American future. And Kurt even writes, I might be too optimistic about this. This picture that I'm painting of someone with a Jewish sounding name named Darien Kunstler, who orders his troops to go out and kill white conservatives because they support Trump. And you have these black gangs running through churches and killing dozens of worshipers in these churches. So when someone says that vision might be too optimistic and that this is a warning for where we should go, I think that we should take it seriously.
And I also think that Kurt knows who his audience is, and he knows what they like. I wrote a story back at the Weekly Standard where I quoted from this 2010 New Yorker interview between Kurt Schlichter and Adam Baldwin, Alec Baldwin's brother, who you might know from, you know, The Patriot or The Last Ship or something. And they're talking about Breitbart.com's commenters, right? I mean, the comment sections are awful on most web pages, but Breitbart particularly so. And so when the subject of commenters came up, they chuckled, quote, "It's a release for a lot of nuts hiding out in the basement," Baldwin said genially, and then here's Schlichter, "so long as they're not on the roof with a rifle."
Jesus.
I mean, this was in 2010, right? This was almost 10 years ago. And, you know, a couple years ago, Schlichter, I mean, aside from these books, was writing articles at townhall.com theorizing about how the deep state might remove Trump from office. And you know who really likes that stuff? Nuts in the basement with rifles.
Well, you know, and this is what's disturbing is the you know, leaving aside the fiction, you also have this, you know, the Flight 93, you know, political vision, which is that, yep, that every election, every issue is life or death, and that the other side is going to kill us all. And so and this rhetoric about the possible, you know, civil war. I saw some poll numbers yesterday. I wish I had them in front of me. Indicating that something like more than 70% of Republicans now believe the Democrats pose a threat to the well-being of the country. Not that we just disagree with them or that their policies are wrong, that the other side now poses, you know, a real threat to the nation. So it may seem like an old story that we are increasingly polarized and tribalized, but there's something else that's entering the bloodstream, which is this sort of apocalyptic vision that the other side is coming for us. They pose a threat to us. We must defend ourselves. And if we do not take extreme measures, we will all die. And how many people do you need? How many unbalanced individuals do you need who, again, marinate in this kind of rhetoric for them to act out and for really bad things to happen? And you could imagine really bad things happening over the next couple of years.
And I think that not only applies to the more militant people who might blow something up, but I think it has a corrosive effect on our civic life as well. When everything is existential and you're not able to lose an election, I think that creates this appetite for radicalism that might not be expressed in a militant way, but just by might be expressed by voting for the worst, most deplorable candidate you can find, as long as they are someone who is going to inflict pain on the other side.
Yeah, and I do think that this the culture we keep coarsening it and coarsening it, you know, assuming that what we're still drawing down the reservoirs of civility, that people will in fact acknowledge the outcome of an election. But you do wonder how much of a tinderbox is out there. So again, I thought your piece was interesting, and also I just think the way in which this sort of, this rhetoric has been quasi mainstreamed. And it's one thing for this bizarre stuff. And again, your piece came out right around the time of the New Zealand massacre. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck by reading the manifesto, which I do not encourage people to do necessarily. And I know that what we like to do is say that these killers are all insane or they're nuts or something like that. But in some ways, that's to reassure us that they're one off. What struck me about the shooter in New Zealand was that he was intelligent, he was ideologically committed, he was trolling in a way that he clearly was trying to get an audience and people who would imitate him. There's an ideology of violence out there that is really disturbing. And I don't think it's too much to suggest that even a Trumpified conservative movement needs to police its borders. And that's not happening. And there is that sort of, Trumpist solidarity. I mean, there are some people who will go too far. I mean, interesting, the D.C. McAllister story that by attacking, a gay man in very graphic terms, that was too much even for the Trumpist right, and she was excommunicated. But Kurt Schlichter can write these fantasies about blowing up black people, and it's like nothing to see here.
Yeah, it goes to show, I think, that the most important thing right now on the right is to have the right friends. And yep. when DC McAllister went after Yashar Ali, he is someone who is popular on the right. He is a liberal journalist, but he has been very good at earning the trust of some of these people on the right. So she happened to insult the wrong person. I think that if she had made similar kind of crude attacks against an editor of the Bulwark, I don't think that I think she would still be writing for the Federalist today.
Probably true.
That is true. It's like, yeah, but and also, well, so there are standards out there, but we're just not sure where they're at. We're just not sure where the lines are. I have to say that one of the things that did surprise me about your piece, Christian, was I did think that guys like Hugh Hewitt would read that and go, okay, you know what? Here's a life lesson. Do not blurb books you haven't read. Okay, I've met this guy. He seemed okay, but now I regret this. But he's doubled down in his defense, And I mean, and you don't get much more mainstream than a guy like Hugh Hewitt.
Well, everyone who blurbed his book, it was Hugh, it was Selena Zito, it was Jim Garrity. Literally no one expressed any remorse, and no one demonstrated to anyone that they had read any of his books.
Yeah, I don't think they read the books. I mean, first of all,
I really hope that's true. The yeah, idea that they would
I hope so. It'd be worse if they did.
The idea they would have read the books. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you'd think it'd be a life lesson, but I think that this goes to what Christian was saying. And you saw this a little bit with DC McAllister, too. A lot of this is all about having the right friends, and I think. I'm not going to impugn either of you, but I know that I'm personally guilty of kind of looking the other way in my earlier years when people in the conservative movement that I was friendly with.
Oh, we all did this, yeah.
Right. Who would express batshit crazy things. I'd be like, well, that guy's or that gal, they're not that bad. Like, I know them. They're cool. But the only time the Federalist people were turning on D.C. McAllister was after D.C. had already turned on them, like Bethany Mandel. Mm-hmm. If Denise hadn't insulted and said very similarly graphic things about her husband, I could imagine her and others being like, well, I mean, come on. I mean, you know, I mean, just coming up with some excuse that, you know, would have not carried any water. But a lot of this is about who you're friends with. And that I think is bad.
So one last thing in the time that we have remaining, you know, if you look at this sort of leaving aside those folks, there is this obsession on the Trumpist right with a certain kind of masculinity. Do you know what I'm getting at, Chris? It is the high testosterone that we are the real men, and that if you do not support our policies, if you do not go down the line with Donald Trump, you are a cuckservative. You are a lesser boy. You are a cabin boy. It is this obsession with a certain kind of manliness that really is kind of extraordinary, you know. And it's there is a distinction, I think, that other writers have made between men as, you know, the sheepdogs who will defend the innocent and who will be, you know, the guardians of the weak and the vulnerable versus the wolf. There is this culture of the wolf that you need to be out there, and manliness is being as mean and nasty and as insensitive as possible. I think, did Kurt Schlichter actually delete his tweet after a young child died? You know, one of the childs was a refugee.
And he said, "I don't care."
He basically said, boy on the beach.
Right. He says, "I don't care." And it was, and I think he deleted it, but it really was a pretty good indication of the way in which they've cultivated this cruelty.
Yeah, the cruelty is a feature, not a bug.
Right.
Right. It's kind of an aesthetic that they want, this vision of masculinity and unapologetic cruelty. And I think that the way to look at it is that it is an aesthetic choice. And it's not really based on ideas or principles. It's what is the image that we are projecting and that we're going to wallow in, because it has this, gives you this kind of transgressive frisson when you when you cross those boundaries. So I think that's more of an attitude and an affectation than anything that's based on ideas or principles.
Well, of course, and in order to get a little bit more, you know, perspective on this particular sort of posture, Hannah Arendt is very, very interesting, talking about the sort of the rise of the mass thug man at different times in our history. So, I mean, none of these things are completely unfamiliar. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. I appreciate it very much. And Christian Stories can be found on The Bulwark, as well as Jim Swift. So, again, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Charlie.
Appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to The Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.